Previously on Popping Collars.
And I know I have just personally been very guilty of typing out the 10 paragraph homily / essay / dissertation in a Facebook comment, thinking that that's just going to solve everyone's, you know, grief or solve everyone's issue. And yet things just continue to roll along like it didn't matter what I said. It's really disappointing.
Did you not read my post?
Did you not read the post? I fixed this
one. I've solved the Glenn
here,
Fry
exactly. Here, let me link to that.
Yeah, that's what I'm going to say.
Okay.
Welcome to Popping Collars, the podcast that lives at the intersection between religion and pop culture. I'm your host. My name is Greg Knight. I am in Palm Beach, Florida. With me is one of my co-hosts, Liz Easton from Omaha, Nebraska. Hello, Liz.
Hey, Greg.
And a couple of special guests. First, from Lancaster, Pennsylvania, making her Popping Collars debut, it's Lauren Scheck. Welcome, Lauren.
Thanks for having me.
And from Austin, Texas, back for more, it's Dan Joslin Simatowski. Welcome, Dan.
Hello, glad to be back.
This is episode 33 of the 1,269th ranked podcast in the iTunes spirituality category. And our topic today is The West Wing. Created by Aaron Sorkin, this political drama follows the personal lives and careers of President Josiah Bartlett and the men and women that make up his fictional administration. So I have a question right off the bat. As someone who came to the show fairly recently, is this really an inside look at the world inside the Beltway, or is it something a little more idealistic, like maybe what politics could look like?
I have no idea because I don't, like, I've never lived in D.C. and I've never even been involved in local politics or anything, but it definitely feels to me as, I wouldn't say idealistic necessarily, but kind of aspirational as an audience. Like, there's a longing for our politicians to be like these folks that we're watching, and sort of a wistfulness that that's how it really is. But I don't know that even as you watch it, that anyone really believes that it's realistic.
Right, like with a staff that works perfectly well together.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And in tandem. I mean, I hope that's what it's like. But juxtapose this with, like, House of Cards.
Mm-hmm.
A totally different look at political office.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it has, there's a literary theorist, Roland Barthes, who calls fiction, you know, the effect of the real, right? Mm-hmm. It has as a way of appearing real because the dialogue moves so quickly and because the actors... There's always a moment in almost each episode where one character gives kind of an insight into how things really work to another character, but you feel like you as a viewer also be given this inside information, right? So you're drawn in to this parallel universe that you hope the White House is like. So I got married when did I get married? Summer of 2000. And my wife and I went on a honeymoon to Halifax, Nova Scotia. And because we were boring people, we were in our bed and breakfast, and we decided to watch TV.
Oh.
You know? So it's Canadian TV, which means it's 6 months behind some things. And so they were showing The West Wing. And I'd heard about it, but I was in a doctoral program, so couldn't really watch TV. I wasn't allowed to. And I was totally taken with The West Wing. I thought, like, if I'd ever seen an Aaron Sorkin thing, I didn't know it, right? And so the quick dialogue and the snappy way of talking about politics, and we're just finishing the Clinton era, I guess, and maybe the Bush election was just about to happen. And it felt like this kind of antidote to a lot of the cynicism of politics, right? We just finished the scandal, the Clinton presidency. I don't know how much you guys remember, but the Clinton presidency did not end well. It kind of ended in shame for him, right? And it's this whole sense of, like, what's his legacy going to be? And so this was, like, this alternate reality for liberals. And I'm from, like, a New Deal Democrat Northeast household. So, like, that whole trajectory is just part of what I grew up on. And the Kennedy idealism and all that. And so I felt like I was mainlining that. And I felt great.
It is the total liberal idea.
And now I think of it as, and as it got more and more popular and kind of obsessively popular during the Bush era, I began to think of it as like liberal nostalgia porn. You know? Like,
yeah.
Only we had a president like Jeb Bartlett. And that's the thing that resonates the most with me is how much of a projection the show works as.
Yeah.
I will match you with my story of discovering the West Wing, which is a little bit different. So I grew up in a family that only had one television set in the whole house. So we really had to agree on TV shows in the evening, which is probably a negotiation that my parents lost most of the time with kids. But The West Wing was the first show that we really watched as a family where we all were kind of old, you know, my brother and I were old enough to understand it. And it became like a family night every week. And I did feel like I was a pretty politically conscious teenager. Like I was on the debate team and on the mock trial team and stuff like that. But it really did feel like a civics lesson for me in a lot of ways. I learned a ton about how government works or how, you know, maybe it ought to work. And because I didn't have a lot of understanding of politics, or at least not a lot of feelings about politics, the Bartlett presidency, for me, felt like a real thing. Like it really, you know, I engaged with it so deeply that it felt like a real, it wasn't a real president. It's kind of a big deal in our family. And then it was on for so long. So like all through college, and I remember watching the finale when I lived here in Omaha right after graduating from college. So,
you know, some of the nostalgia for real presidents isn't for a real president.
Right.
We know that to be true in church when it's like the beloved rector from 40 years ago. Who even knows that person anymore?
Right.
Just
exactly.
A story of a story, and they'll use it to either prop up or hold against the new person.
Yeah, you forget the bad stuff. You always forget the bad stuff. It's like an old relationship. You forget the bad stuff.
I only remember the bad stuff.
Yeah.
I forget all the good stuff.
Yeah. Never mind. So much of this is, and I think you should write, Lauren, when you were talking about like the way that these people work and the way that they work well together and stuff like that. And I think what I took away from that and what I always take away from the show is that idea of working. Like these people are constantly working, like at all hours of the day they're at work. They don't seem to have any relationships outside of their relationships at work. I mean, you know, I mentioned in the opening, like, it gets into the personal lives of these people, but really it gets into the personal life of the president. Everybody else is just kind of a staffer, and that's their role.
I know I've talked about this on Popping Collars before, but one of my favorite, like, subgenres of movies and TVs and everything is stories about people who love their jobs and do them well. Like, for some reason, that just, like, I'm a person who loves my job, but that just gets me. So, like, The West Wing is, like, the ultimate expression of that for me. Like, and for so many of us, even if you don't work as much as the people on The West Wing do, certainly, most of us, a whole huge proportion of our lives is lived at work among the people that we work with. So it's so kind of beautiful and encouraging to see how those people really love each other and care for each other and support one another in really real ways. That just always gets me.
Well, it's one of the ways in which Sorkin kind of puts the American dream in front of you, the American dream that if you work hard enough, especially if you work hard enough in a job you love, anything is possible. And even when there's these ups and downs, there's always a sense of you have your colleagues to support you, and you can move up the ranks as well. We see it with somebody like Charlie, right, who begins as an intern, and you're always rooting for Charlie to, you know, give that one extra bit of effort, and, you know, he gradually gets rewarded as the series unfolds.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a disconnect that I have with the show, which is there's sort of this inherent goodness to all of the characters. It's like, you know, and sort of holding this whole thing down is this kind of messiah figure president who he went to Notre Dame because he was thinking about becoming a priest. And it's like, ah, really, Bartlett? Like, you are killing me with this sappiness. Like, this is totally driving me crazy. Like, how decent and how good can somebody be? And how, you know, and that seems to just kind of drive the show.
I love that because, like, a little insight into my personality is that I literally think that everybody is like that. I have this kind of assumption of goodness and benevolence and integrity in everyone that I meet and work with. And in some ways, that's a real handicap for me. But you know, so far, so good.
You know, nobody can be too good for you, though.
No.
Not Liz.
No, I mean, I definitely fall short of that standard constantly, which is probably what builds it up in other people for me. But no, like, I just love the idea that people are going about their work, especially important work, with a ton of integrity. I mean, that's what I hope, you know.
Yeah.
No, it's not true. I encounter it's not being true all the time, but...
What you found as kind of too impossibly good, Greg, is one of the things that I think is why... As I referenced this before, with the Bush administration, when so much of this was airing, there was so many of the fans who were contrasting Bush, War on Terror, questions about torture, with Bartlett, who you thought Bartlett would never torture anyone, right? And I think that comes up towards the end of the series. For me, watching The West Wing, part of what I bought into was this moral relief that I could imagine a president who was good.
Yeah, it feels great to watch it because you're sort of thinking to yourself, this is what my ninth grade civics class was telling me this was the whole time. And then you watch the news or you see what's going on in modern day politics, current campaign rhetoric, for instance, and stuff like that. And you recognize that that's a fantasy. Like, I mean, that's so far removed from how politics actually works.
But isn't that maybe what draws us to this show and why it's still popular now, because it isn't the gritty underside backbiting, and it is truly the fantasy / nostalgia for what never was and how we really want it to be.
It makes me wonder, with the people that we work with in our parishes and our churches and the various churches that Liz and sort of Lauren work at and stuff, it makes me curious if we're creating a world where we're constantly separating ourselves, aren't we creating an atmosphere where it's harder to find common ground with each other? So we've recently gone through a series of events at my parish where people have opted to leave the parish rather than stick it out and communicate through whatever it is their grievances with the parish, right? And it seems like that becomes more and more of an option. This idea that, you know, we don't have this shared experience anymore. I have my thing and you have your thing, and so I'm just going to take off.
I think it depends on the cultural context too of our congregations. Like, I spent Shrove Tuesday in a really small church in Hyannis, Nebraska, which is a ranching community. And after the pancake supper, we kind of went down to the bar on Main Street to have a beer before Ash Wednesday. And it was the night where the returns from the New Hampshire primary were being broadcast. So in this little bar in Hyannis, Nebraska, you could just sense from the conversations people were having and weren't having that their political opinions actually were pretty diverse. But what bonded them and kept them together was ranching. So they're, you know, that was is a huge cultural indicator for them, but their politics may not be the same. So I think it kind of depends on where you are. Like, yeah, in a big urban congregation where there's a lot more diversity, there might not be those bonding and binding factors. But the fact is, our congregations across the Episcopal Church are usually, you know, oftentimes in more homogeneous spots.
Yeah, that's one of the things in my making the move from teaching in Berkeley, California, and teaching in Austin, Texas, was I wanted to move to a part of the country where there was the potential for more diversity of viewpoints within the Episcopal Church context. And even though people say Austin is the Berkeley of Texas, those are people who have never been to Berkeley. I mean, it might be if you're from a rural ranching community, like this seems like a totally different place, but it's possible, to run into a diversity of viewpoints that I would never have encountered in most of the parishes in my previous location. That ended up being a really important value for me. It's hard, but I think the vitality of our church depends on some kind of reconciliation, which means not being homogenous.
Mm-hmm. I was actually thinking more so about my previous diocese, which is Arizona, and how they went about it a different way of having different views. Instead of saying we're all going to be in this together and maybe we will talk about some of our differences, but we'll listen to each other, it was like, let's just not ever talk about any of the differences.
Right.
And that's how we'll get along, because, you know, we don't have to hear anyone say, love the sinner, hate the sin, if we just never go down any alley where we need to say that. Mm-hmm. Or where someone might want to say that.
Honestly, it just makes me wonder if, you know, this idea that we're all called, we can all be in our different places in life and believing, you know, have our different worldviews and believe our different beliefs and stuff like that. But ultimately, we're all called to the same table. You know, we're all sharing the same meal. We're all sort of united at the altar together. It makes me wonder if that, kind of like the West Wing, is the idealized view of the Episcopal Church experience, and the reality of it is that we're not all at that altar together. Like, some of us are, and some of us are heading out the door. I don't know.
Well, you know, I've been thinking a lot about the, you know me, I like the Anglican Communion church politics. I post about that quite a bit. And, you know, for me, the witness of Michael Curry at the primates meeting, where there's a sense of, okay, many other primates around the communion were very upset with Curry about the stances of the Episcopal Church on human sexuality. And he said, essentially, that's true, and I want to stay at this table with you. And the primates were willing to say, we want to stay at this table with you as well. And even though it's painful, what's been happening to the Episcopal Church, it's also a witness to this willingness to stay together, which I think is part of what this tradition has to offer to Christianity, even though we do it really imperfectly. We value unity as such a high thing that we try to do almost anything it takes to stay together.
I was thinking of this idea of that we had brought up before, of Bartlett being kind of this moral good in the role of the presidency, and this idea that there can be a presentation of an unashamed politician. He loves what he does. He loves his country. He's a patriot. Like, he uses all of that language. You know, the show literally wraps him in a flag every week during the opening credits. I wonder, so we have two priests on the show. Is your life as a priest what you thought it would be when you
first felt this call? Think that 75% of my job would be responding to emails. I got in this job to be with people and to serve God.
Right.
And most of the time, I'm serving God by answering someone's email. And that's a hard pill to swallow some days.
Like, I didn't feel any ontological change. I'll say that for sure. And I think maybe part of me thought that I would. And, you know, I was kind of maybe naive about that. But I feel a real consistency in my life and my values and the things that I care about and the things I do well and the things I do badly from before I was a priest through now. But yeah, I didn't get a whole lot of surprises. It surprised me. Actually, no, I'll say this. It surprises me how little people care in the community. Like, yeah. I've never had anybody comment about my clerical collar ever. Mm. It's just never been a point of conversation. And I remember, like, the first time that I went to the grocery store in a clerical collar, just feeling like I had a spotlight around my neck. You know, it's like, and nobody cares. I don't think people even know what they are.
You know, I'm not a priest, so I don't know, like, I don't know that end of things. I will say, as someone that's been working in parishes for the last few years, like, I think that what I've taken away from the experience of working at churches is how insular they are. Like, they're so, like, you can get so rolled up in the world of the parish and the parishioners and the lives of the parishioners and the staff and gossiping about the staff and gossiping about the parishioners and gossiping about the clergy. And that becomes like this end all be all to the point that you, like, you come home and you're saying things that, like, nobody cares about, right? Because, but to you, it's your whole world. Like, because you've seen, like, every aspect of it, every sort of in and out of it. And it takes kind of a switching of the brain to think, oh yeah, there's more out there than just this parish and the people that are here and all of that.
Yeah, you know, seminary teaching can also be very all-consuming. And it's even worse than a parish because it's a seminary.
It's a transient community.
Like, no one knows what happens in a seminary, and everyone rolls over every 3 years or every 2 years, depending how long they're there. And, you know, my first couple of years, first teaching seminary, I totally over-identified with the student body. Some of you were there for some of that, you know. I'm like, realizing that, you know, like, even though they're my age peers, they're not my peers. And then they're going to leave. And so figuring out, like, how to have a healthy balance. In some ways, leaving one seminary job for another seminary job was a way of no longer being overloaded. I had to get out of one context, which I felt so overcommitted, right? And that loops back to the West Wing, right?
I know, I was thinking that too.
The only thing is this job. And I think that definitely is a big part of church life, is you're giving yourself to God, aren't you? Right? Doesn't God deserve everything? And so what's the difference between God and your job? Right? And the difference between your job and your students or your parishioners and God, because we believe that God's being reflected back at you.
Yeah, I definitely, like, when you were talking about the sense of duty, Liz, like, that resonated with me in watching the show. And then when, you know, and then, of course, this idea of this ticking clock, this idea that at some point, every one of those staffers has to leave that job. Like, they're not going to, that's not a life position, right? Like, they're not going to stay. They're going to go out, and there's going to be a new press secretary and a new chief of staff and a new deputy chief. You know, like, all of those things are going to get replaced, and they're all going to turn over. But in that time that you have in that position, you do your duty to the best of your ability. And that's where it kind of resonates, I think, with this life of the priest.
I'm going back to that red clay country. I'm going back to that red clay country. I'm going back to that red clay country. That's my home, boys. That's my home. There ain't no hammer in these mountains. There ain't no like mine, boys.
we've started something called the 5-Minute Coffee Hour. So if somebody has something that they're just dying to talk about from pop culture or your life or something like that, something that you would tend to talk about, like over a bagel and a styrofoam cup of Maxwell House, like on a Sunday morning, we just kind of have a little impromptu conversation about it. And so, but before we get to that, Dan, is there anything you want to plug? A church website, a blog, Twitter?
Well,
feed,
you know, the best way to find me is Seminary of the Southwest website, ssw.edu. That way you can learn how to spell my last name, and then you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. And my seminary has a blog called sewingholyquestions.org. Each faculty member writes a blog each week. I've written one recently about my trip to Rome. It's worth a read if you want to get a slice of how we're thinking about things down here in Austin.
Lauren, you have your contact information now.
The best way to find me is on Twitter, and I'm at Reverend Lauren. You have to spell Reverend all the way out. And you'll see mainly church things, but also adorable pictures of my bulldogs.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. So who has something that they would like to bring to our 5-Minute Coffee Hour? Who's seen something amazing over the last week, month or so? Go ahead, Liz.
So I watched Mozart in the Jungle on Amazon Prime.
Oh, really?
Oh, my gosh.
Everyone's talking about that show.
I saw it win the Golden Globes, and I was like, I don't know. It seems like work.
No, I felt the same way. It seemed cheesy. And it fits into my, my favorite genre of people who work hard and love what they do, because it's about the New York Symphony. And it's just delightful. It's 30-minute episodes. The music is gorgeous. Gabriel Garcia Bernal is, like, hot. I'm not kidding.
He's totes my goats.
Oh, my gosh. He's just adorable. And, all of the little dynamics of people who work together in a creative field that feels unsettling and uncertain. And it tied in really interestingly with church, because one of the storylines is that the symphony is kind of in financial trouble and they're constantly raising money and there's this high overhead. And the conversation that they're having at the board level is our relevance is disappearing. You know, where are the young people to replace the older donors? And, you know, what can we do to make ourselves cool? And then this alternate narrative of, like, we can't make ourselves cool. We just need to play the classics really well. And it sounds a lot like conversations we have about the church.
Everything you just said, if you hadn't said the word symphony, I would have thought you were talking about church.
Right.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And it's a great reminder, too, that we're not alone in this weird cultural moment of things disappearing and us not knowing what to do with them. Like, this is a broad, we're all going to get there, and I believe we're all going to get through it, but we're feeling it on every level of culture.
Cool.
Oh, yeah, man. Mozart in the Jungle, really?
Yeah.
That's ambitious, Liz. Good job.
Thanks. I watched 2 seasons.
Whoa.
Wow.
Yeah.
I didn't know there were 2 seasons.
Right. I got this.
I got to tell you, God love the Golden Globes for giving shows like that awards, because honestly, I would have never heard of that show if it hadn't won the Golden Globe.
It's great. And here's the thing. I got this Fitbit. I've talked about the Fitbit before. I'm like a cyborg. And I'm working out more, and that means that I can watch a couple episodes of Mozart in the Jungle when I'm at the gym. It's just a perfect little show to stream. You don't have to pay too much attention, but it's really great.
I watched Last Week Tonight with John Oliver while I'm at the gym, and I feel bad because I think people think I'm laughing at them. But there's nothing and having big belly laughs at the same time, which are really fun.
Yeah, I try not to watch anything that I react to at the gym. Like, I try to stay stone-faced at the gym. That's why I had to stop watching Archer at the gym.
That's wrong.
I was reacting to Archer too much.
That's wrong.
I haven't plugged all of the Popping Collar stuff yet, so let me go ahead and do that first, and then we'll end the show. You can find Popping Collars on the web at poppingcollarspodcast.com, where you can find each and every one of our episodes. You can find us on Twitter at Popping Collars. You can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/poppingcollars. And feel free to subscribe to our show on iTunes. Rate and review us. That'll help people get to see that we're out there, and hopefully one of these days we'll crack the top 1,000. We're working on it. Slowly. slowly chipping away. We're also featured on Episcopal Cafe every single time. We love Episcopal Cafe, and we know you will too. Check their website out for all your Episcopal news and beyond. And with that, that's Popping Collars for this time. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, Lauren. Thank you, Dan, for coming on the show. Keep those collars popped, and we'll see you next time.